You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, come on in. The water is fine. Like I was telling you a little bit earlier, what we needed to do today, we found out the availability of a couple of what I want to call brainiacs, doing a whole bunch of research at the University of Hawaii Manoa, part of a big program. And to sort of explain it, it's really topical because some of you saw the big story in the paper last week about shark and shark attacks, and you saw the bitten surfboard and these big bad sharks, and we got to do something to eradicate them and all that stuff. Maybe not. Dr. Mark Fitchett from the council joins us to introduce us to some other special folks. I feel like there's a bunch of science in my building here, Mark. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at Manoa.
Yeah, so thanks for Mike. with us, we have Dr. Carl Meyer, who's a faculty member at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, UH, and Derek Kraft, who's here. Both of them have expertise in shark biology and shark ecology, as well as Derek, who is a expert in genetics. So we have a lot of problems we've been facing at the council that have come to us from our constituents regarding the depredation of catch from sharks. Yeah. We've heard about it here in Hawaii quite a bit. We hear about it in bottom fishing, but in the Marianas, Guam and off of Saipan especially, where there's a little bit of troll fishing as well, there have been a lot of complaints with the depredation of their catch. And obviously, approaching the fishermen to help them address their problem can be a little tricky because there's already a little bit of distrust when it comes to bridging the gap between fishermen and scientists, and they don't want this information used against them. But however, a lot of them understand, like we do here in Hawaii, that we need to get a bigger picture on what species are there. And later down the future, how to mitigate these problems. So when we were discussing this problem initially with some folks, with groups of scientists throughout the region, we got the chance to talk to Carl. And one thing that Dr. Meyer really spoke to us that really stuck out was, not only did he already have a game plan on how to address the issue of identification, but immediately he's in the back of his mind, you can see the gears turning on a solution to the problem rather than just identifying what's happening and getting a better picture of the problem itself, but coming in for a solution.
Yeah, so that's really interesting because it's like I was talking off the air. I met Dr. Meyer just a little bit ago, and that was, you know, you watch these TV shows now with facial rec and forensics and all of this stuff, And when this is applied into fields where you can see the fruits of the labor, I'm fascinated. Everybody knows when the shark's around that if you ask five different people about a shark, you get five different descriptions and five different species. Well, there are ways that you can really narrow that down. And one of the first things I want to learn and get excited about with Dr. Meyer, with Carl, is that part of it, the forensic part of it. But first, I think maybe the big picture, in that we've talked about sharks so much recently. I mean, we love them and we hate them, right? We're scared to death of them. And is it okay to blame them for every fish that we don't get in the boat because there's a shark there, or is it we're interrupting their food chain? What got you interested in this whole thing in the first place?
Well, Mike, the type of research that I do has two main areas of focus. First, it's understanding the world of sharks generally, and secondly, looking closely at ways of reducing the conflict between sharks and people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a number of areas under that particular heading. So the shark depredation issue is something that automatically interested me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we use the term shark depredation, and it basically means sharks stealing the fish that you've caught.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because there's some people on the Big Island that have the same feeling about porpoise, because they go to what they call the ground to catch aqua to use as bait. And every third fish comes in just ahead, because the porpoise know to go right behind them and suck that body off the hook and leave the hook alone. And they used to blame them on sharks, but they're not sharks, they're porpoise.
Yeah, so there's a number of animals out there that like to have a free lunch.
Yeah.
And a hooked fish, or even a fish in a net, is easy prey for marine predators. Mm. But the thing that we hear about most often are sharks taking people's catches, and it's a problem in Hawaii, it's a problem in the Marianas, and in many places around the world. Mm. Now, it's actually a fairly tough nut to crack, because sharks are smart, and the process of fishing is actually training sharks to be better at stealing catches.
Oh, geez. It's a byproduct that we don't want, right?
If you think about it, what happens is we tend to go out to the same spots again and again that we know are good places to catch certain types of fish.
Sure.
And when we get out there, we do the same things. We use lines that we drop to the bottom to catch bottom fishes, or we troll lures at the surface. Mm-hmm. And the first time a shark encounters a struggling fish on a line, there's some other things in its environment. There's a boat. It's producing engine noise. Mm-hmm. And if that shark grabs that fish and eats it, that's some positive reinforcement. It's a bit like when you train a dog to behave in a certain way by giving it food rewards.
Yeah, a treat, sure.
The sharks are rewarded when they're able to associate the location and the sound of the boat and perhaps the gear itself, and they become better at it over time. So what we're trying to do is to find ways of undoing that so that fishermen can get more of their catch on board.
They used to call it a Pavlovian response, right, with a dog. But you're talking about the same thing, where sharks will act that way, given the, you know, the bell's ringing, meaning I hear the engine, that much means it's lunchtime, let's go eat.
Yeah, so it's a conditioned response, broadly, is what we would call it. And instead of a bell in this circumstance, you have something like a boat engine, which can be heard, particularly a diesel engine. Sharks can detect that a long way off, and they can respond to that, having associated it with a food reward. So, you know, once this behavior gets going, it can ramp up over time.
Okay.
And it's difficult to undo it, and that's where science comes in. And we have a three-phase approach to looking at the problem. And it starts with really understanding the types of sharks that are involved and also the behavior that's happening specifically around the fishing gear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the starting point for us. And then the second phase is we have tracking technologies that we can use. So once we know which types of sharks are involved, we can equip them with transmitters and then figure out whether there are times or seasons on the fishing grounds where the fish are there, but the sharks are not. That's one option for reducing the amount of catch that's lost. And then the holy grail is to develop a repellent device that can be integrated into your fishing gear that will keep the sharks away from the hooked fish. And so we're looking at technologies for doing that. And the type of technology we know might work is something based on electricity, because
I was going to ask you that. I mean, we're moving into more of that. You can explain to us how the sharks, how the physics match that. You know, in other words, if you're going to be able to use something electronic, it might be as simple a thing as dialing up a certain frequency and not hurting anybody else, but just getting the shark to either get unhungry or go away.
Yeah, so you hit the nail on the head there, Mike. The sharks are electrosensitive, and the kinds of fishes we're interested in catching are not. And so we can use an electric field to deter the shark from the fish. Now, obviously, there's a lot of engineering goes into that, and that is the ultimate solution, if you will. But right now, we are focusing on the first phase of the project, which is to better understand the types of sharks that are involved in this depredation and to get a sense of their behavior. And to do that, we're bringing a couple of tools to the table. Now, to see what's going on, we have small video cameras that we actually put directly into the fishing gear.
All hail GoPro, right, these days?
Yeah.
Or similar things.
We have a smaller version, and we do have some GoPro cameras as well with different types of housing, so we can get a good view. And then we have the CSI approach as well, where we're going to use some genetic tools to determine exactly what the species involved in damaging or stealing the catch are.
It's really amazing, and maybe a good juncture to bring Derek Crafton. You talked to me about a little bit about Derek. Explain who Derek is, and we're gonna get his end of the deal. Is he marches towards his PhD?
Yeah. So Derek is our genetics whiz, and although I talk about these genetics tools, Derek is the expert here, so he's the one that takes the swabs that we use to collect transfer DNA.
Okay, and I forgot to everybody. That's what Dr. Meyer and I were talking about before we started recording, and he explained a little bit who Derek is. And Derek, what he was telling me, first of all, welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having us out.
My pleasure. Now, to me, it's very interesting because what Dr. Meyer said is when you go through an incident, if you get there to the right amount of time, you can tell probably what species, what shark bit this guy or bit this surfboard or bit whatever. How do you do that, man?
Absolutely, yeah. So we've actually done some of that in our lab. We're testing bites on surfboards to try to get shark length. And
just had that happen the other day, right? Somebody, there's one in the paper, big old white surfboard with these big teeth marks in it.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a great white or it was a tiger.
Yeah, so there's always that. Everyone thinks they know what kind, but a lot of it's speculation. With the DNA, though, it's a positive for sure answer. If we can get the DNA off of it, we know what species it is for sure.
Truly amazing.
Yeah, so the shark saliva is actually really, really sticky. Mm-hmm. If you think about how they breathe, they open up their mouth, water flows through it, so their saliva has to be really sticky, otherwise they have to regenerate it all the time. Mm-hmm. So when they bite onto something, a lot of that saliva has DNA in it. It's going to stick to that object.
Is it important to get at that quickly?
So we don't actually know the time frame yet. There's a lot of groundwork that needs to be done to figure out those kind of answers. So we're just encouraging, as quickly as we can. We've done it off the boat. We've had a tiger shark on and stuck a surfboard in its mouth and swabbed it right away, and we were able to get DNA off of it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we're doing it now with the fishermen, because turns out if they bring in half a fish head, there'll be some shark DNA left on that fish, and you can actually swab it.
Terrific. Yeah.
Therefore, we came up with all these kits to hand out to the fishermen themselves, and when they bring in a part of fish or a fish with a bite out of it, they'll have the kits on board and be able to sample it fairly quickly and get it on ice.
What I like about this, gang, it's not games. I mean, you know, it may seem like it's a bunch of fun, but isn't it neat, once again, Dr. Meyer, not only have young guys coming up the pipe to pick up this technology, but that it's even there? Because I'm sure when you started, 90% of what we're talking about wasn't a reality yet.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've been studying sharks for almost 30 years, and the kinds of tools that we have available to us today were really just fantasies 30 years ago. So we're lucky to have a lot more tools to bring to the table now, and that's helping us to get much deeper insights into the hidden lives of sharks.
Yeah, what I was thinking, it was kind of neat, and Derek, you mentioned that, is that a concerned fisherman can really, if he knows where to go and who to call after a trip, can really say, hey, you know what, this might help. I mean, you know, I want to do every little bit that helps. I know, Mark, that we're talking about, and other things that we talk about here on the program, our listeners, the fishermen and their families, they have to buy into this because they have to understand what all this research is all about. And, you know, that's why from the council level, we always want to say, you know, you go to wpcouncil.org and look at this and look at that. How did this thing fit together with the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in this particular part of what you're doing?
So one of our former council members and whose son is a member of the council right now, Manny Duenez, was very vocal about this issue for many years because there was a concern that some of the sharks that were that were depredating, stealing their fish, as they would say, in both bottom fishing and in troll fishing, whether they were residents, they didn't know what species there were. And it's just also frustrating. So to them, there is just having some value and at least somebody addressing the problem from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And they've been voicing this issue for God knows how many years, way long before I was here. And so finally, last year, it was high time. We actually were able to finally secure some funding to do this project, and it took a lot of efforts to get that into fruition. But one of the things that, as I mentioned earlier, when we needed to find some experts who could address this, we were very, very well aware of the work that Carl had been doing on other projects. Also, just we have a very strong local shark expert knowledge base here.
Sure,
we have some of the best in the world here. Here just down the road at HIMB. And so when we were talking to scientists, we talked to a few people here and there to get us some ideas. We talked to some folks in the Marianas, And one of the things that stuck out for us was, as Carl mentioned, he's looking at this from a three-phased approach, was not only identifying the project, but allowing some sort of mechanism to continue it to find a solution.
Yeah, that's what we're primarily the most interested in right
now. And we're at such the base level in recent years that we didn't even know what species were involved. And of course, there could be species that are protected species. And so this is also not a problem that is just unique to small boat fishermen and sharks. There's other issues with false killer whales and things like that that come in for other fisheries. So this may be an excellent springboard, this project that Derek and Carl are talking about for more and bigger and better things, and how we can improve reducing our interactions with non-target species.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, gang. And the reason why we do this is because a lot of this is, wow. I'll tell you why. If you take a look at the Discovery Channel, every time they do the Shark Week, it's the highest rated week of the year they have for them. We have this love-hate relationship with these animals. I don't know which movie you got to watch, but Dr. Meyer, when you started 30 years ago, this stuff was a pet, you know, was a dream. So it must be a credit to all institutions like UH and others that even realize the importance of continuing this research, because it seems like never ending. For example, what if a kid says, how many different kinds of sharks are there? Most people think, I don't know, about six, you know?
Yeah, there's...
I mean, how many of them? I mean, I don't know if there's a limit. There's so many.
Well, if you look at specifically sharks, I think it's around about 350 different species. And we have a bunch of those species in our waters in Hawaii.
Right here, you bet.
You know, for example, the kinds of species that fishermen are likely to encounter include things like sandbar sharks, Galapagos sharks, tiger sharks, black tip sharks, then more pelagic species like mako sharks and thresher sharks. And there's a whole bunch of species that actually are here in Hawaii. In fact, we're within a couple of miles of them sitting in the studio, but most people will never ever see because they live deep and never come shallow. So we have enormous things like blunt-nosed six-gill sharks, which you know, we've caught them up to almost 18 feet in length.
No, boy.
And, you know, most people will never see those. But Hawaii is actually a great place to be a shark. You know, the shark populations here appear to be fundamentally healthy. That's not the case in other parts of the world, largely due to the shark fin industry. And, of course, it's a double-edged sword in some respects. If you're a fisherman, an abundance of sharks tells you that your ecosystem is fundamentally healthy.
I was going to say vibrant and healthy.
You do not have these top predators unless your ecosystem is healthy. But at the same time, you end up in competition with those sharks. And so one thing that we focus on in our research is trying to figure out ways that we can reduce that competition. Because my impression, talking to fishermen here and elsewhere, is that they really don't have a problem with sharks until they get into the catch loss. And you know, they're quite happy. They like the fact that the ocean is healthy, but the loss of the catch is a real issue. And you can understand that from a fisherman's perspective, there are fixed costs every time you go out. You know, you're not going to get that money for gas back, whatever happens. No. And so when you start to lose particularly high-value bottom fishes, you don't have to have many taken before your profit margins whittled away. So there's a strong incentive there to try and find solutions to these kinds of issues.
Yeah, and that's very important, gang, for you to pick that up. Because if you've been with us on previous programs with Mark Fitchett and others, and his recent and Roy Morioka and many of the other guys that we deal with, the effort and the catch and the expense of going fishing, for instance, the other day when we had a captain from a longline boat in here, Carl, it was they're anywhere from $26,000 to $28,000 in the hole when they leave to go fishing. So they're not, you know, catching fish for fun is not on their agenda. What they're trying to do is put the money back in the boat. And obviously, if you keep going to the same grounds like you mentioned, and that's where your big eye is, that's where your sharks are. That's where your swordfish are, for whatever. So they're using this. Are they setting up a them and us situation here where sharks are bad, we got to get rid of them? It kills me to see some of the pictures where we see literally thousands of shark fins hanging from clotheslines and places in the Orient that are going to be used for food or for soup or for aphrodisiac. How bad is it, and how badly do we need these sharks?
Well, the problem is bad, but it's a mosaic. So there are parts of the world like Hawaii where sharks are not targeted like that, and they are still, their populations are fundamentally healthy. But in other parts of the world, the sharks have been largely depleted by intensive fishing to supply the shark fin soup industry, because it's a very high value fishery. I mean, sometimes these dried fins are going for more than 100 US a kilo. So that's,
more from what I understand.
You know, I'm going to let Derek weigh in here, because he actually, as part of his PhD, has been looking at the shark fin industry. So he's got some good numbers on that.
Yeah. Derek, isn't it, Derek, very, very difficult to try to explain somebody that's weighing the money they make from catching something to stop doing it? I mean, some of these people are unbelievable. I don't even know if we can appreciate here in Hawaii how much these fins are worth.
Yeah, I've gotten some references. It's around 700 a kilogram for fins.
By the way, that's 2 pounds, not even 2 pounds. Jeez.
Yeah. So 350 a pound.
Yeah.
Just for the fins. Yeah. And the thing is, you can catch a lot. You can keep a lot of them on a boat if you're removing them from the shark and
Here's the problem is you're finning them.
Yeah.
And now this shark, if it's not already dead, will be, because he can't swim anymore. You know,
right.
That's what the fins are all about.
Yep. Yeah. So these guys can go out and collect thousands and thousands of pounds of fins, bring in a lot of money, but that's also thousands and thousands of sharks that they've killed.
Yeah.
And this happens on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can even begin to appreciate it here in Hawaii. Interesting what Carl was talking about, right? With respect to, we don't know the depth and width of this program. It's way bigger than what we think.
Yeah, if you spend any time out at some really remote atolls around the oceans, where there really is no protection, there's no people around, you go diving there and there are no sharks. I spent almost 10 days in Kiribati, just the Christmas Island in the South Pacific, and in 3 dives a day for 10 days, I only saw one shark, which is unheard of.
We didn't rehearse any of this stuff, but have your travels ever taken you to the Papahanaumokuakea in that reserve? And particularly, from what I understand, is where you would think the apex predator would be the shark. From what I understand now, there's huge schools of ulua that are just huge. They're more probably devastating than the sharks are for what they eat.
So I've been fortunate to have worked up in Papahanaumokuakea for almost 20 years. And so I've done hundreds and hundreds of dives up there. Mm. And what I will tell you is that both sharks and ulua are very abundant up there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, so are things that are highly sought after in the main Hawaiian Islands. Like, I have seen the biggest kumu in my life up there.
Tell me that. I'm going. I'm going to paddle there on a surfboard.
You can see a school of 7-pound kumu swimming around out in the open in the day. There are lots of lobsters up there still. And so what you see is that when you have a more intact ecosystem, it allows resource species, the things that we're interested in, to be abundant as well. So even though there are lots of uluas and lots of sharks, the species that we like to catch for food are also plentiful. Now, that might be partly due to the fact that these top predators help to regulate marine food webs. So some people might think, well, look, you know, the solution here, you know, if you've got a problem with sharks stealing fish, is just to get rid of all of the sharks, then we can have all of the fish. But guess what? It's not that simple, because in marine food webs, there are these feedback mechanisms. So, for example, sharks, although they're stealing fish, they're also going out and eating things that they would naturally. And some of the things that they eat may be predators of the juveniles of important resource species.
Oh boy.
So the sharks eat species A, which, if they weren't doing, would become much more abundant, and then species A would eat species B, or perhaps the juveniles of species B, and species B is something that we're interested in.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to be a little bit careful about apparent simple solutions like, hey, let's go out and get rid of all the sharks, mm-hmm. because then we'll have tons of fish. Well, it might not work that way. And although it's a little counterintuitive, we certainly see that places that have healthy predator populations tend to have healthy populations of species that we're interested in as
and,
well.
And, you know, I guess in the final analysis, one of the things that we try to do, gang, with this program from the council, and don't forget, a lot of this you can learn yourself by going to wpcouncil.org and tracking on where we've been and where we're going. Don't we need to have sort of a paradigm shift in who's cooperating in not just the research, but in this, in trying to find the solutions? Because I agree, and maybe that's where you come in, Derek, that you're working, you know, in the field. And I hope you have a chance to interact with the fishermen as much as you do with the fish, because there's a lot of people out there that would be well served to listen to programs like this and to try to find out where we really stand with this stuff and not just rely on somebody who is out of sorts with sharks and mad at them and trying to tell you we got to go kill all the sharks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And down in Guam, you know, this was just a week ago, I got the opportunity to go out on the fishing boats, a lot of these fishermen. In fact, we're reliant on those fishermen down there for this project to even happen, and they've been great. We've met a lot. We're really excited about the project. They know, they understand the value of the sharks, and that, you know, if killing them all was the solution, A, they may have already done it, but B, they realize it's also going to take a lot of time. So their perspective is really open-minded, and for the most part, most of them were pretty excited for us to come along.
Yeah, and, you know, it's probably maybe from Carl Meyer, maybe from the UH standpoint and from the Institute of Marine Biology, Manoa standpoint, it's well and easy and great to have the ability to do this research. But I know there's a great burden on saying, okay, we do all of these studies. What's the application of it? Why are we doing these things? And what do we want to, at the end of the day, what do we want to achieve?
Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Mike. And we are, you know, as a university, obviously we do both fundamental research, which is just to gain an understanding of how, in our case, the oceans work.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also wanting to apply that research as well. Yes. So we're looking at real world problems as well as blue skies questions. Mm-hmm. You know, and this shark depredation is one example of how we're using our scientific tools to try and find solutions to a real world problem. We're also heavily involved in looking at the interactions between sharks and people. So, you know, when you're out surfing, for example, you know, you're always concerned that a shark might come and bite you. So, you know, we put a lot of effort into understanding those dynamics. And, you know, these are complex situations, and there are often no magic bullets that we can use to make the problem go away just instantaneously. But through a lot of hard work, we can gradually put together piece by piece that big picture that helps us to gain the understanding and identify possible strategies that can be used to reduce whatever problem, you know, we're dealing with.
Yeah, and that's, Dr. Fitcher, a pretty good thing, Mark, that we're talking about this and the ability not only for the council to be aware of who these folks are, but what they're doing, but how it can be useful in explaining the big picture. It's, I think more and more people are getting to realize that, yeah, we better look at all of this. We can, you know, it's not good sense to think we can just keep taking and thinking there's nothing at the end of it, particularly with these things like sharks or monk seals or anything else that we're interfering with.
Yeah, I mean, there's many different facets to this problem, as Carl explained very thoroughly. You know, you reduce one component of the ecosystem, it can cause issues elsewhere, including for resources that humans are interested in. And so rather, humans need to not be just interested in one part of the ecosystem, the food web, but the bigger picture, as you said. Secondly, there's a lot of intrinsic value in just showing outsiders in the community that you are cooperating to, you know, reduce interactions with a species that other folks may see and value more than let's say fisheries. So what I mean by that is, you know, we're working and we're cooperating with the fishermen and bridging the gap between science and the fishing groups, and letting the fishing a community understand and then prove by doing these type of projects that they are not only committed to reducing the interactions with, say, protected species like sharks or sharks and protected species, but it's sort of proof that they are working to improve the ecosystem as a whole rather than just be focusing on exploiting. And I think that's the issue. I think a lot of folks need to understand is that the fishing, that a fisherman does not inherently want to ruin his return on investment in the ecosystem in the future. So
I got to eat now, you know, but and we could literally go on for hours and hours, but for time constraints, I want to maybe wrap up this particular session by heading in another direction, and that is, and I guess this is where I think what we first started talking about, Dr. Meyer, was important, is that sometimes there's a food chain that's a natural organized food chain and there's no problem. And then there's one that man is involved somewhere in that food chain where we come in and disrupt a lot of things. So obviously some of this research is going to give us maybe guidelines of when to catch certain things, when to avoid certain things. And then you're talking about also having the opportunity to have technology or equipment interface with our thinking so that we can actually physically, electronically control these animals somehow.
Yeah, so in terms of actual solutions that we can see to this issue of catches being taken, first of all, there's sort of a soft option, if you will, of, well, we'll figure out the problem times of the year, the problem times of day, or perhaps times of the tide when sharks are most prevalent on the fishing grounds, and see whether there's any gaps there that still have the fish present but don't have the sharks. And so the fishermen can then strategize around that. So for example, in Hawaii, my understanding is that as we get into the warmer months, the problems with depredation in the bottom fish fishery become much greater. Mm-hmm. So that it suggests that there's a water temperature element to the sharks' perhaps presence, or certainly their feeding patterns.
Yeah, somewhere in there also, Dr. Myers, is the fact that we fishermen tend to react to what the water like. And those of us that are bottom fishermen going out in deep water, if it's bumpy and lumpy, forget about it. Well, that might be the perfect time. There might be more fish there, you know. So there seem to be a lot of variables that you're able to put into the hopper to come up with solutions for.
Exactly. And we have to do these sort of large-scale, broad analyses to get that big picture and identify possible solutions, like time-based solutions. Yeah. But as I mentioned before, the Holy Grail is something that you can integrate into your fishing gear that will keep the sharks away but still allow you to catch fish.
That and ideally, and maybe it's kind of Derek, before we run out of time, that's kind of where you are. You know you're the up and comer on this thing, and so having these opportunities and having this equipment, can you appreciate how difficult it would have been for Carl years ago to come up with what you're doing now, like easy, you know, just because of the more tools you have, the more likely the more work you're going to be able to get done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really common theme I actually hear from even Carl and some of my other advisors who did their PhDs 20, some of them 30 years ago, and how easy you kids have it nowadays is a common theme.
Yeah, I've heard that. Oh, when I was your age, I had to walk through the blizzard to get to school in the morning with no shoes.
Uphill, you know, both ways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But obviously, to keep motivated, what are the wins so far outside of being able to talk the word, tack the title doctor onto your name down the road here? what are you getting out of this? What are you discovering personally satisfying?
I've actually really enjoyed listening and getting to know the fishermen. Mm-hmm. Them having me out, you know, I feel like it's a privilege to go out with them and listening to their stories and listening to how the fish were doing over time and with their shark stuff, and also being able to share our side of things. Yeah. You know, we're lucky we get all this technology, these cool little cameras. I told the fishermen I can actually stick a camera on their trawling line that's not going to affect their fishing.
That's truly amazing.
Yeah. And I've gone through about 5 hours of footage so far, and we have a couple awesome shots. You know, we've got some mahi hooking up and swimming around, and one shot of a mahi being interested in a lure, and here comes a shark up behind it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Mahi didn't hook up, and then they swam away 10 seconds later. But
it's ironic that you say that, because last week, we were working with Guy Nita, and Guy's got contraptions to make a dead bait look live and troll. And he has a camera that they've been using in research, and it shows Ono and Mai Mai coming into the lure pattern and deciding what they're going to eat by going to the fish, not the lures. because and they tell the difference. But I'm thinking, Mark, and because of time we do have to roll, we want to do this some more with these guys. But talk about that, the ability to incorporate this massive amount of research they're doing into what you guys are doing to, when you go to a Fishers Forum or when you go to your legislators or when you go to the Longline Association to find out how are we going to keep catching fish and keep catching fish tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's we're right now we're at the first stage of this project that Carl and his team and Derek have been putting forward. The next step is coming up with ways on how we can come up with management solutions, maybe gear modifications, things that we can do with the help of experts like Carl to reduce bycatch, not just to sharks but other species as well. Here in Hawaii, you know, we have a community around us. Even the fishing community is very, I would say, eco-friendly and eco-centric. It's not like other parts of the U.S. where there is a directly, I think there's a more of a very, I would say, narrow-minded view when it comes to fishing. Here in Hawaii, I think the community is very well versed in the importance in reducing bycatch, but putting that in practice is the next thing that we need to do. Hopefully working continuously, working more with Carl to get some research done and funding out there on actual gear mods that we can do, not just for troll fisheries, perhaps for long lines, for our small boat fisheries as well.
And, you know, we've done that already with some of the gear modifications. And as you know, we're the most observed fishery in the country, in the world, and all of that stuff. But, well, listen, I'm thrilled to be able to start the ball rolling on this. Derek Kraft, nice meeting you, my friend, and done more success. Then pretty soon, next time you're going to be Dr. Kraft.
I hope so.
And once again, Carl, it must be really neat after 30 years to find out that there's solutions that are really kind of within the grasp of what we're doing here.
Yeah, you know, we keep forging towards it to you know, try and solve these problems. Yeah.
Nice meeting you, before we'll see you again. And Mark, we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
You want to hear something on the program, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Go catch a lot of fish. Leave some for me. And we'll see you next time. In the meantime, you want to find out about this and other episodes of what we do, go to wpcouncil.org. That's wpcouncil.org. See you.